From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. So yes, we have results from yesterday's California primary and Super Tuesday, but in California, most of them are unofficial and many of them will change. Ken Rudin, the political junkie, is back with me as our election coverage continues. Hi, Ken.
Good morning, Beth.
Voter data analyst from Political Data Inc., Paul Mitchell, is in the studio as well. Hello.
Good morning.
Here we are. So impressions from both of you. Ken.
Well, I mean, it was a great night for Joe Biden. We were counting him for dead before South Carolina. The momentum from that victory on February 29th was expanding. He got the endorsements of people who dropped out, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, and today with Michael Bloomberg out of the race, he got that endorsement. And it's not only the African-American vote. It's one thing to say, well, we kind of knew he would win Alabama. We knew he would win Virginia or North Carolina. But he won in Massachusetts. We thought that it was Bernie Sanders, who was going to take on Elizabeth
and
Warren.
And Minnesota. Where Bernie Sanders had won before.
Exactly the words. I love when you finish my sentences. But that's exactly, and that's why it was much more overwhelming. And I can't help but think that all those voters who went to the polls, well, or at least sent in absentee ballots weeks ago, what those votes would have looked like had they waited for Super Tuesday to cast those votes.
That's a point that you made yesterday, Paul. So what's your impression of what happened?
Well, I mean, definitely the presidential race was amazing to watch. And as we discussed yesterday, there essentially were two Californias. There was the California that was voting those first 27 days of voting, and then the voters that cast their ballot in the last 2 days. But then the other takeaway is waking up this morning and, you know, looking at the election results, realizing that in most of these races, we're only halfway there. Like the amount of votes outstanding could be equal to the amount of votes that we have currently counted. And in some cases, it might even be more outstanding than counted.
Give the example of what's happening in an assembly district in the South.
Yeah. So there's this assembly district in Southern California where California has a top two system. And every once in a while in these contests, you get a result where, say, a Republican district, the top two ends up being two Democrats, and all the Republicans split up the vote. And it looks like that's happening in the inverse here in the 38th Assembly District, where an assemblywoman is running for the congressional seat. So she vacated her seat. A number of Democratic candidates ran, and they're all kind of at 9%, 10%, 14%, 14%. And then the two Republicans, it looks like, are going to make the runoff. One's at 19 and one's at 33. So it's this anomaly of our election system where what should be considered a safe Democratic seat is probably going to end up being a Republican seat, at least for 2 years.
In a race in California, as you refer to top two, if a candidate gets 50% of the vote plus one, that's an automatic win. And in a bit, I'm pausing. In nonpartisan races,
yes,
correct?
In nonpartisan races, yes. Yeah, and it depends on if there's some nonpartisan races have a runoff and some nonpartisan races don't. But our top two system, which is pretty unique to California in the way that we administer our open primaries, the top two candidates, regardless of party, in this kind of race will go to the runoff. Now, there is
In November,
which is a long ways away, right? Honestly, I mean, we have the March primary.
Do you hear how many clarifications we have to make to our rules? No wonder people are sometimes intimidated or confused about how we do this.
No, we have a confusing election system, and nothing is more confusing than when we say it's an open primary, it's an open primary, it's an open primary. And then in the presidential race, what we just had, it's like, oh, if you want to vote for a Democratic candidate for president, it's not an open primary. You have to actually request that crossover ballot. You don't just get it automatically.
And if you want to vote for the Republican, you have to re-register as a Republican.
Yeah, so those changes in the rules, I think
you're going to be able to gather data to see what kind of influence that had, won't you?
Yeah, we're going to be able to see the rates at which people requested replacement ballots and some of those issues. But, you know, most of what we saw was long lines, a lot of people having problems, especially like in L.A. County this election cycle, getting the right ballot was really trouble for some people.
Let's listen to a little bit of sound going back to the presidential race. And here's a clip from Joe Biden's remarks last night.
A few days ago, the press and the pundits had declared the campaign dead. And then came South Carolina. There's something to say about it. And we're told, well, when you got to Super Tuesday, it'd be over. Well, it may be over for the other guy.
At some moments, it seemed that maybe the most surprised person yesterday was Joe Biden.
Well, he's run for president three times.
Right.
And as of Friday of last week, he had never won a state. And so he wins his first state on Saturday night in South Carolina, and then he goes and wins, what, nine more?
Ten if you include Maine, right?
Wow, so 10 more. So that's, I mean, it's kind of amazing. So yeah, he should wake up this morning being pretty surprised at this amazing turnaround he's had with, you know, after decades of running for president. I have a Joe Biden for president poster that I've had for probably 20 years.
Remember, this is the guy who ran in 1988, but he dropped out in 1987 because of a controversy. In 2008, when he ran, he dropped out the day of the Iowa caucuses. So you're absolutely right. Before South Carolina, Joe Biden, for all the times he's run for president, had never won. And now they're talking about him being unstoppable, which is, shows how fickle not only are the voters, but how fickle the analysis has been in this kind of topsy-turvy race.
Do you have campaign buttons from all those Joe Biden races?
Oh, my goodness. Starting in 1972, when, as you remember, in Delaware, he defeated Senator Jay Caleb Boggs. Remember that?
I remember that, yeah.
Now we
hey,
do.
Hey, come on. You kids.
I sold my diaper that day.
You kids today. Oh, God.
All right, let's listen to a bit of Bernie Sanders, who was doing his version of celebrating last night.
And when we began this race for the presidency, everybody said it couldn't be done. But tonight, I tell you with absolute confidence, we are going to win the Democratic nomination. And we are going to defeat the most dangerous president in the history of this country.
So Bernie Sanders suddenly wasn't facing just individuals, opponents. He now has to take on, and it became apparent last night, that he is facing a very critical, powerful core of the Democratic Party.
That's absolutely right. It is the core because there's a coalescing behind Joe Biden. There is such a strong hunger. I don't know how much the voters love Joe Biden, but they definitely want President Trump defeated. And polls seem to indicate, and Biden's argument from the beginning is that he was best equipped to do that. What Bernie Sanders' argument always was, that he would bring in a large surge of new voters, and Paul can address this better than I can, of course, but the new voters that were going to come to the polls and help Bernie Sanders win. But I don't know if we saw yesterday, and of course we're still counting votes, I don't know if we've seen that surge in new voters, and that also hurts Bernie Sanders' argument.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. You do have two competing arguments. One is that a more progressive candidate can bring out people who are less likely to vote, and by doing that, they could win in the general election. The other argument is that you can be a moderate, you can get some independents, maybe get even some crossover Republicans and win through that path. And we've seen even in California congressional races that win from both paths. But, you know, that's what we're going to have going forward into the rest of this nomination process, is a campaign that's really based on, can Biden coalesce this establishment in order to win the nomination, or is Sanders going to be able to grow the electorate in a way in these coming states to take that nomination?
We are expecting in this hour to talk with the GOP chair of San Joaquin County. And let me just take a look right now at our technical team to see whether Dwight Williams is on the phone right now. Is Dwight Williams, Pastor Williams, standing by with us? Let's bring him into the conversation and see what his reaction, somebody who's really in and on the Trump team, looked at Super Tuesday and felt last night. Pastor Williams, glad to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Beth. It's great to be with you.
How did Super Tuesday look to you and look to the Republicans in San Joaquin County?
It looks like that there is a coalescing, if you will, around Vice President Biden. The establishment definitely, I think, hit a panic button. They realize that, oh, my God, we're getting ready to elect someone who's not even a Democrat, and he is a Democratic Socialist. That could spell problems for us. And they rapidly moved in breakneck speed, if you will, to get behind Vice President Biden. I think as far as the Trump campaign goes, and Republicans in San Joaquin County, we're ready for whoever the Democratic field sorts out. The Democrats still have several months to play at this, but whether or not it is Vice President Biden, like right now the momentum is going to him, or who knows, this could flip back within 6 weeks and go back to Bernie Sanders. The Republicans are ready for the 2020 cycle, without doubt.
I heard you saying that the Democrats were hitting the panic button, and that for many people, whoever the Democratic nominee is, the race seems crystal clear to you. Why are you so sure of that? Why are you so sure in your constituency that the outcome seems obvious?
Well, no, I'm not saying that it's obvious. I just think that when you have an Amy Klobuchar, a Pete Buttigieg, a Tom Steyer, and now this morning, Mayor Bloomberg, all of them get out and rally behind Bernie Sanders. It's obvious.
Joe Biden.
Behind Joe Biden. Obviously, what they're trying to do is they're trying to stop Bernie Sanders. The worry is that if Bernie gets the nomination, they could have some severe problems. And I think they, in their heart, realize that. So that's the reason why you have all of these candidates coming out right now and then getting behind Vice President Biden, because they don't want Bernie at the top of the ticket. So I think that is a growing fear that they have. So they're coalescing behind Vice President Biden. And I'll even go one better. I'll go one better. I would not be surprised if in the next 30 to 45 days, within that time, President Obama comes out and put his arms around Vice President Biden and just seals the deal. So, he bring and put his arms around Joe, and then they'll go back and reminisce about the 8 years of the Obama-Biden administration, and that definitely would be the fait accompli, if you will, of sorts.
One more question, and I'm talking to Dwight Williams, GOP chair in San Joaquin County. Tell me about California and what you're seeing today in early returns on the races across the state and the voice of Republicans in some of the races. And, I mean, Josh Harder's race in particular. I'd like your reaction.
In CD10, Congressman Josh Harder is in a real significant race that's emerging between Dr. Ted House and himself. CD10 is a priority for us as a party to pick back up. Former Congressman Jeff Dunham had that seat, and for years they have been trying to get that seat away, which they were able to do a couple of years ago. And right now there seems to be a coalescing and a coming together to get behind, do whatever is necessary to get that seat back. So I congratulate all of the candidates in that race, all the Republican candidates in that race. Looking like Dr. House is going to be the person that's going to run against Congressman Harder. There will be a coalescing around Dr. House. It's going to be a very competitive race in CD10.
All right. We're always appreciating your time, Pastor Williams. Glad to have you with us today on Insight, and we look forward to continuing this conversation with you.
Thanks, Beth. It's great also to be with you, too.
Yeah, I appreciate that you make time for us. And Dwight Williams is the GOP chair of San Joaquin County. On the phone with us is Sacramento's Mayor Daryl Steinberg, and I need to let him know who's here excited to listen and talk with him, because we just had West Sacramento Mayor Chris Cabaldon join us in the studio. Welcome to you, Mayor. Glad to have you here.
Great to be with both Beth and my fellow and favorite mayor, Chris Cabaldon.
Also, we have Ken Rudin, the political junkie, and our data analyst, Paul Mitchell. So it's a real morning stop at the coffee shop here on Insight.
I love it. Love to be part of it.
All right. So right now, the early vote is a 73% affirmation total for you. What does that say to you, Mr. Mayor?
Well, it feels good. I mean, I did not have major competition this time. And when you win an election, you only have two reactions. One is thank you to the people of Sacramento. And two, I'm sitting at my desk here at City Hall ready to get back to work. And that's the way I do it. That's the way Maryka Baldwin does it. We just focus on big things and getting a lot of things done along the way, and that's what I'm going to continue to do. People have known me for 25 years in this city as a public official, and what you see is what you get.
There are Sacramento City Council races that are far too close to call, and it's too early, but it divided city council members, and then the council members divided in different ways over Measure G, the Sacramento Children's Fund Act. So it's clear that as a team, you and the city council have different interests, different directions, and there might be new incoming members after November. How does that landscape look to you?
Well, just like in the Democratic presidential primary, I think competition of ideas is a good and healthy thing. And we've got a very unified city council, but yes, we've disagreed on a couple things. Measure G is one of them. My dear friend Jay Chenier supported Measure G, and I opposed it. And we'll see what happens. Certainly the no side is winning now, but there's so many votes left to count. I don't know what will happen. But, you know, my view is that we have an obligation to follow through on the promises we made in November 2018 when the voters passed Measure U, and that is to invest in youth, but also affordable housing and homelessness and economic strategies for our neighborhoods and, of course, youth. But we need to follow through on what we promised, and I think my alternative gives us a better chance to do that.
So, Mayor Steinberg, we spent time in a lot of different communities ahead of the primary this week talking to people about issues, and I think you know what came out on top, what is coming out on top in every area across this region. And, well, take a guess. It's a topic you love.
It must be homelessness.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Well, not a surprise. I mean, I spend half of my time as mayor, if not more, working on the issues of affordable housing and homelessness. And maybe that includes my role as Governor Newsom's co-chair of a statewide task force on homelessness. I still believe, and I know, in fact, that we have laid a foundation in this city to begin to bend the curve, not to cure the problem, but to make it better. By the summer, we're going to have 700 new or repurposed beds to get people in and out every 4 to 6 months and move people into longer-term housing. And that's just the beginning.
I'm going to pause you because before we get into the weeds about homelessness,
I
just want to find out, is this the issue that's ultimately going to define your mayorship in spite of all the other things, all the other changes that are happening to Sacramento? Will it be about what happens on this subject during the time that you're in office?
Well, I don't do the legacy thing, really. I mean, I think it's up to the people. I will be judged in part by whether or not we have made this better. Again, not cured it, but people begin to feel a difference. But I hope I'll be evaluated based on many other things. What we're doing to partner with Mayor Cabaldon to do the Sacramento side of the waterfront, where we've got $50 million now at play. It's going to be unbelievable on our side. What we're doing with the rail yards, what we're doing with Measure U and inclusive economic development in our neighborhood. So I work hard on homelessness, but I'm far from a one-issue mayor because, one, the job demands that you pay attention to many things, and two, I have many passions.
No mayor can be a one-issue mayor,
no.
But I'm going to thank you for your time and leave you with one question. So voters at this point are saying 73% yes, we want him to be mayor. So on homelessness, let's do a 1 to 10 scale, with 10 being the most effective and the most successful. Where do you rate yourself? 1 to 10 on homelessness in the city, what do you give yourself now?
I would give myself a 5. I think we've laid the right foundation over my first 3 years. We've leaned in. We need the help of many other jurisdictions throughout the entire region to do the same. But I'd say 5, but I'm going to get to 8 or 9 before I'm done. And if you know anything about my career, I actually do get the job done, even if it's imperfect along the way. So that's what another 4 years is about. It's about being able to take what we've started here and to be able to make a demonstrable difference, not just on homelessness, but on elevating Sacramento as the next great American city as part of a great region. And I think we're well on our way.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Always appreciate it.
Thank you, Beth.
All right. So there you have it, a little bit from Sacramento's mayor and West Sacramento's mayor is joining us, Chris Cabaldon. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Glad to have you here. I was so excited for this conversation. Of course, there's a lot to say about West Sacramento, but many people know you've had a very high profile and key role in the Pete Buttigieg campaign for president, and you're really just off that trail and able to talk with us about it.
Yeah, I finally got some sleep. Not for very long, but yeah, I signed on to that campaign because I knew the person a year ago, and I knew how brilliant he was and how emotionally intelligent he was and how effective he could be, and also that this was a time in the country where we needed something completely different and to focus on what was dividing us and figuring out how we could come back together. I wanted a chance to show the rest of the country what that possibility was. And I guess along the way, it's been so heartwarming to see the response. America has had moments of love affairs with Pete and with his husband. And this was a situation where, you know, a year and a half ago, when he first mentioned it to me, I thought, you're a friend, I'll help. But that's insane. There's no way you could possibly do this, both because you're the mayor of a small city, but mostly because what gives you any sense that America might be ready for an LGBT serious candidate? And to see not only that was America ready, but that he was a front runner at points of the campaign, the first one ever to win delegates, but in places like rural Iowa and completely improbable and unexpected parts of America. So I felt really good about the campaign, and when he called to say, it's time. I told him, look, what we've done here is something extraordinary. And America, when you give it a chance, when you like put a choice in front, not just a polling question, but you say, look, here, really make a choice about your future, America usually steps up and finds its better angels. And so it's been a really extraordinary opportunity, completely out of my pay grade. I'm the mayor of I'm a nonpartisan mayor of a small town. But what a terrific opportunity and what to really make history.
I'm not sure how many people know how you knew Pete Buttigieg or how that started. So what's the short version of that story?
About 5 years ago, he came out. He was about to 6 months out from running for re-election in Indiana, right during the time that Governor Pence was proposing all of these anti-gay state laws. He came out and he was about to come to his very first national mayor's meeting. And I said, I have to find that guy. One, I want to see what does a out mayor in Indiana, what does that look like? And second, he probably needs a buddy, somebody to take him under his wing and show him the ropes and introduce him around. He didn't really need that. So I met him in San Francisco 5 years ago at the mayor's meeting, and took him around, and his humility and yet his strength of presence, and instantly the mayors of New York and Los Angeles were respecting him, but also seeing, I think, in themselves a different kind of ways to lead, and his capacity even on the campaign to calm. Hmm. Which I think was the campaigns aren't just about who wants to spend the most on healthcare, how you might reconfigure the Department of Energy. I mean, issues matter, but I found in this campaign that it was just as much about the mental health of the country and our belief in each other again, and Pete's ability to be both really smart, but to help you feel calm. Not in the sense like, let's take a nap calm, but calm like we need to tune out the noise to focus on doing what needs to get done has been so powerful.
I want Ken Rudin and Paul Mitchell to jump in here, too. I think we're interested in hearing some of that behind the scenes and the response, the reaction. But go ahead, Ken.
Well, I just thought I was especially struck by the fact that you have this 38-year-old wunderkind who comes in, runs for president when nobody expected, did better than anybody expected, and then he endorses a 77-year-old who would be, of course, the old. We go from the youngest president to the oldest. When you saw Pete Buttigieg on the stage endorsing the former vice president, what did you feel?
Well, I think I felt, of course, I feel sad. I'm not getting like some email every 5 seconds or text message asking for money or to go volunteer in some other state. So the end of it, you know, there's no way to not to be so personally invested and not feel that. But that particular endorsement was something really extraordinary because, Pete lost his father at the very beginning of this campaign, whose father was about Joe's age. And and Pete's dad's name was Joe, and in the in that press conference, Vice President Biden, talked about Pete like his son Beau, who was killed.
Beau Biden.
Yeah, exactly.
Who died of cancer.
Yes, and so the two of them together, it was a really profound moment of both generations coming together, but not in some sort of coalition, but in terms of the basic human bond that we share. The other thing I loved about it was the essence of what so much of what Pete's campaign was, which was about the human. It was about that reconnecting with one another right there on stage. So politically, it was at the beginning, it was a little hard to watch, although I had also just endorsed Vice President Biden myself. But as a human being and then thinking about the possibilities for the country, it was so powerful, profound, and hopeful.
Do we haven't seen the last of Pete Buttigieg?
I'm pretty sure we'll see him again, and the vice president certainly said that too.
You know, press releases were still coming out about him campaigning for Super Tuesday and being here in the state. How quickly was this happening behind the scenes?
It happened very quickly. I mean, I think the decision was made overnight between Saturday and Sunday. Once it was made very quickly. Pete decided that this is what we need to do for the country and also actually for the campaign team. And if we're going to make a difference in uniting first the Democratic Party and then the country, we have to move now and redeploy the Pete for America, all the volunteers, all the professionals, all the really creative millennials that have been driving this campaign, redeploy them. And that's what happened. So you saw that the ground operation all over the country basically got transferred over and really helped to power the surge.
One quick question. We talk about all the money that Pete raised in 2019, 2020, yet he basically spent everything in Iowa and New Hampshire. What do you make of a system that when Iowa and New Hampshire have such oversized importance that all the money is gone and what are you left with?
Well, I think the bigger issue is money, just money in politics more generally. I've never been a fan of the Iowa-New Hampshire system. When I went to Iowa, though, I have to say what I loved about it was people there really took this seriously. Mm-hmm. You know, you would talk to people.
The tradition is so
important.
Yeah,
and it's like, well, the country has vested in me the solemn duty of choosing the president. And so and I get a second choice and maybe a third choice. And so it doesn't turn into a bloodlust. Like so much of our politics is, people are still listening and talking and asking questions and talking to each other up until the last moment. And so if you wanted an insight about how a democracy should work, whether it's the right demographics and all of that is a different question, but how a democracy should conduct itself, Iowa was a really terrific example of what we might aspire to.
Hey, Christopher, it's great to see you. my question is, it seems as though the country, at least the states that were on Super Tuesday, really were kind of making up their mind, going from this multi-way field into kind of this binary between Sanders and Biden. You had to make this choice personally as Pete exited the race. Where was your thinking and how did you process essentially deciding where you were going to put your support as a mayor and as a leader in California?
The number 1 through 10 consideration for me after Pete made his decision, I didn't know who he was going to endorse, but I had to make a choice for myself. Was what's going to turn the page and change this White House? That was fundamental. There's no, I care about community development block grants and federal support for homelessness services and all of that, but there's no policy issue that's more important to me than that. There's no other narrative. I'm not looking for a cabinet secretary post. I'm happy in my local city. So just what's that?
Vice president?
No, thank you. I returned all the calls from all the campaigns and candidates and just had that conversation. And by the end of the day, I was convinced. That Vice President Biden was the right choice for that purpose. But I have to say, the fact that we had such a field was also quite heartwarming this season, and that people had to make some hard choices. But yeah, I made that choice solely based on what the end result should be, and I think that's what the country did too. I think finally folks just said focus, focus, focus. Let's get this done.
So one last question: how about the national arena of politics? And we know you love your lifelong career job as mayor of West Sacramento, but is that other arena one that you want to continue to have a role in and work in?
You know, I play a leadership role in the U.S. Conference of Mayors along with Mayor Steinberg, I get the chance to have an impact on things that matter, both for me and for my city already.
Is that enough?
It's enough. You know, I enjoyed doing this campaign like the first time and maybe the last. The sort of the rough and tumble bloodlust of national politics is not the same as being able to go to the Nugget or to Sutter Health Park or to the Barn and engage in politics and then get something real done. So I love what I do at the local level, and it's given me also the platform and the opportunity to make a difference on state things and national things, and once in a while on global issues as well. So this was never for me about making my way to the bitter cold of Washington D.C. in the winter. I love where I'm at.
Thank you so much for making time for us today. I know a lot of people are happy to see you back on campus and back around the neighborhood again. West Sacramento Mayor Christopher Combalden, who has been a key part of the Pete Buttigieg campaign. Glad to have you on Insight.
Thanks so much, Beth.
We're going to take a short break. There's much more to come. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio.